Bald Bros, I've just received a podcast. Our superiors say it's too long, and we can all go home. Goodney's getting paid off for his crimes, and our friends will have all listened to 49 episodes for nothing. But we can all go home. Meanwhile, ideas like peace, freedom, and good video game films, they get packed up. But we can all go home. Well, I'm not going home. I'm going to get on my podcast, and I'm going online. I'm going to kick that son of a bitch Goodney's ass so hard that the next Goodney wannabe is going to feel it. Now, who wants to go home, and who wants to podcast with me?
Welcome, one and all, to episode 50 of A Bald Opinion, the podcast about video game films. My name is Gunnar, your host, ever your host. Today we will be talking about the one and only Street Fighter from 1994, the Steven E. D'Souza
Tour de Force.
Films to be most proud of all of them, all the films that he's done. With me along for the ride is, as always, my companion and the fighter in the streets, Neil Prentice. How are you, Neil?
Hello, Goodney.
That was me trying to say it like Hadouken, but smooth. You know, it wasn't fully successful, but You know, that's going to be the mantra for this whole episode.
Yeah, you tried and it didn't work. Street Fighter, this is one of the big ones. This is the big one
this
that everybody knows about.
Is a doozy of a property and a film for us to talk about. It has scared us, Goodney. Is it fair to say that?
No. it's just so big. Like, everything about it is big.
Yeah, like, there is so much that you could talk about with this film. There is so much that has been written about this film that I'll admit I was a little overwhelmed just at the thought of doing it, okay? I'm not perfect, Goodney, okay?
This is shocking.
I'm not
news.
The hero you think I am.
What? Street Fighter, did you play it as a kid? I mean, you didn't like fighting games. But then again, neither did I.
So I had played it a little on the Sega Mega Drive. Never owned it. It was only borrowed from friends. So I'd play it a little bit and then immediately kind of lose and then start losing interest. What I do remember is cheating. So you do a tournament and then you get player two and you press start. And then you just fight an empty
character. Empty shell of a man, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember beating the crap out of a car.
Yes.
And a brick wall.
Yeah, never quite understood where that came from. I played a horrible NES port of Street Fighter 1 or 2, which wasn't particularly enjoyable, but I've kind of dipped my toe into the other games, you know, over the years. To me, they all feel very samey, and we kind of mentioned it before we started recording that it seems like they're really, you know, digging the same hole again, or like doing the same thing over and over again, basically.
There might be big Street Fighter fans who will get very riled up at us saying this, Goodney, and they will come and find us and start punching our cars. But it is almost kind of like, now this is very demeaning towards a very popular franchise, but like that saying about how a broken clock is at least right twice a day, that they basically just kept releasing or re-releasing with slight updates throughout the years, and throughout the 2000s, it wasn't popular, and then it became insanely popular again. And it's, they found what they were good at and they stuck at it.
It felt like Street Fighter 2, I mean, I haven't done the research, but I would assume that Street Fighter 2 is one of the most remastered / re-released games of all time, because I don't know how many different versions I have seen of Street Fighter 2. Not just ports, but also just like, you know, Super Edition or Duper Duper Edition or whatever.
So I could say more on that, but let's then just jump into the history of Street Fighter.
Right.
I had the task of doing that. The important thing to remember, dear listeners, is that this history, I will take you up to 1994, when this film is then released, for that is all that is important to us. Anything that comes after, while mildly interesting, is of no interest to us bald people. So, imagine if you will, let me set the scene. Sitting in a Capcom sales team meeting, bored out of his mind, you have designer Takashi Nishiyama, and he's daydreaming and he's sketching. And on his little piece of paper, he starts sketching some characters and an idea. And that idea is Street Fighter. He takes this idea, he shows it to one of his colleagues, they take it to the head honchos, they like it. What Takashi has done is he's taken this an idea that's inspired by Kung Fu Master, which was a 1984 arcade game that he himself was part of the design team for. And he was inspired by Game of Death, the Bruce Lee film. And this is about like one-on-one battles. So he took the one-on-one boss battles from Kung Fu and decided to base a whole game around it. And that is Street Fighter, the original game that comes out in 1987, only has two playable characters, Ryu, who represents Japan, and Ken, who represents the US.
Wait, really? There was just two characters?
Yep. They handle the same, and, you know, you choose your character and you go and you fight the tournament. In this game, there are other characters, but the only one that really matters to us is Sagat, because he and Ryu and Ken are the only ones that make the jump to Street Fighter 2. When it was released in the arcades, I like this thing, it's quite interesting. It came with two systems. You have your classic six button system, which, you know, represent like the punching and kicking. Mm-hmm. And then there was a two button system. And it worked by, depending on how hard you hit either button, was like how hard they was what type of punch or kick you would get.
Oh.
Which is a cool idea.
Very cool.
But can you imagine, you know, an 11-year-old off their face on sugar in the arcade, just smashing the... I liked it because it reminded me of when me and my brothers played... an Olympics game that we had, and there was this other game that track and field, that's what it was called.
Oh yeah.
And to run, you had to press square and X. So what we did was we blue tacked it to a table and we would just smash it down and the plastic would start just like chipping off the back. So that's what I had in my mind when I heard that. It was a hit-ish. It was popular. It was well liked. But, you know, it wasn't the huge success you might have thought. But it was popular enough to warrant a sequel. So what they did was they brought in a new team because after the release, you have Takashi Nishiyama. He leaves. He leaves the company and goes and does something else. So they bring in people who worked on 1989's Final Fight, which, you know, is basically... a ripoff of Street Fighter, or is it, or Street Fighter 2, a ripoff of Final Fight, who knows, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. They take the three characters I mentioned, they add a bunch of others, and they make Street Fighter 2. So in Street Fighter 2, we see everything, as always, go up a notch. The visuals improve. It's more colorful, it's more vibrant. And you also have easier to execute commands, special moves, smoother animations. But the big thing is you can fight each other. And now this is something that's really important to the success of Street Fighter 2, because they released the game into arcades in 1992, and it's a moderate hit. Then they... try to figure out what it is. They go, they do a recce, they look at it in it, you know, in an arcade. They see it's kind of popular, but everybody's just playing it one at a time, doing the tournament, and, you know, it's not really engaging or, you know, setting the world alight. So they remarket it as fight your friends one-on-one. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, it just becomes insanely popular. Becomes the highest grossing arcade game in Japan and the US in 92. And really just starts the ball rolling for what Capcom just do for the next, you know, several decades of just re-release Street Fighter 2, re-release Street Fighter 2. So in the game, you have Ken, Ryu, Ryu, and Sagat, the boss character from 1. But they also added Chun-Li, Guile, Blanka, Dalsim, Zangief, and E. Honda. You had non-playable characters that were Vega, Balrog, Sagat, and M. Bison. These were guys that you would fight, mm-hmm. like bosses that you would fight. Big success. Then, in 92, a few months after that release, you get Champion Edition, where those bosses that weren't playable, Goodney, mm-hmm. they're now playable. Then, a few months later, you get Street Fighter 2 Turbo. It's a faster game mode, additional balancing, and new special moves. Then in 93, we get Street Fighter 2, new challengers, 4 new playable characters. Then in 94, we get Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo. Air combos, super combos, new characters, and we get ports. So in 92, we have the port for Amiga, Atari, Commodore 64, which was available on cassette. Nice. I can never get over the fact that you get cassette games. I think we've mentioned it before.
Yeah, it's magic. It's magic to me.
Yeah, I had a Commodore 64, or my brother had it. So it was one of the first like systems I played. And just this idea of like this cassette is magic. Anyway, so Amstrad, CPC, the Spectrum, PC, DOS, and some crappy little system, Goodney, called NES.
Yep.
The only losers played.
Wasn't a good port, gotta say.
So I was thinking about that like the vibrant colors that you would have got in the arcade, absolutely you will not have got anywhere near that on these home releases.
No, you remember when I sent you a video of the NES version of Lion King, like comparing that to the Sega.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a similar thing. It was barbaric, but it was all I had at the time.
The only other game I'm going to mention, because it would have come out in 94, maybe 95, is Street Fighter the movie, where they go full Mortal Kombat, but with Street Fighter based on the movie. And it was hated.
Yeah.
Like nobody likes it.
It looks really weird. It is the only case that I know of a game based on a movie, based on a game.
Arguably Ratchet and Clank, the remaster.
But yeah, well, that was kind of a side, like they were made at the same time, sort of. But can you imagine like a Mario game mm-hmm. based on the original Mario movie? Like starring Bob Hoskins.
I'm sure another exists. I'll rack my brain and then probably yell it out midway through this episode.
The movie one, because the whole point of this movie, the reason Capcom wanted to make it was that they wanted to sell toys. Not mm-hmm. games, toys. So they were in cooperation with this company that made the G.I. Joe toys, which weren't really selling anymore. And they had already taken a crack at making a Street Fighter toy line using old G.I. Joe models, but just painted differently. So they looked a bit terrible and nobody wanted them. And then they made this film, and then they made toys based on the film, and they also did not sell great, because nobody wants a Guile that looks like Jean-Claude Van Damme. And then they decided to make a video game, because the main competitor of Street Fighter at the time was Mortal Kombat. And Mortal Kombat was sort of like for adults, because it was bloody, mm-hmm. because it was, you know, this, I forget the name of the technology, where they basically just take photographs of you and put you in the system so it looks real.
I think Goodney is called Photoreal.
Photoreal, yeah, sort of. Let's go with that, Photoreal. And what ended up happening was that this bastardization that ended up between Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter, which was neither but also both, and nobody liked. And it has like Jean-Claude and all those guys but it just plays like crap because they didn't have access to the source code of the original Street Fighter, which would have made a huge difference if it actually was like just Street Fighter 2, but everyone looks real. That would have been a whole different ballgame.
Just like reskinned for the movie. That would have been cool.
Yeah, but it was like,
well, maybe not.
But the whole game is apparently, like I was reading about it, it's just this soup of compromises. Like they had to cut a few characters because even though they shot them and everything, like Blanca and everything, it was like big, but they just ran out of time. And like Jean-Claude, they were all contracted to show up for like 8 hours of mocap or whatever, or photography. He showed up for like, you know, 3-4 hours and then just left. So his stunt double had to come in and take over.
From what I've heard about this movie, Goodney, I am shocked that the making of this game was difficult.
Shocked to the core, you know, yeah.
Shocked to the core. So before Goodney jumps in to describe this film, let me just remind you that we're looking at Street Fighter, a one-on-one side-scroll brawler fighting thing.
Remind them of that.
Yes.
Okay, so there is a place called Shadaloo. And in Shadaloo, a tyrant reigns.
Shadaloo. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Sorry, I was trying to sing Waterloo.
Called M. Bison. Now, M. Bison is played by Raul Julia. And I think this is his last part, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Yeah. He is just a big old bad guy, and he wants $10 billion or $20 billion?
$20 billion
from the rest of the world. The way he aims to get the money is he takes a bunch of hostages and then gives everybody 3 days to pay him the $20 billion. Thankfully, though, Guile, Colonel William Guile, played by Jean-Claude Van Damme, an all-American hero with an American flag on his shoulder and no American accent, has his military troops stationed around Shadaloo or in Shadaloo ready to fight M. Bison. There are also Ryu and Ken, who are these fraudsters who sell phony weapons to arms dealers around the world. They are also in Shadaloo.
We'll discuss that. We'll discuss that in a moment.
There is Chun Li, a reporter, and her two associates. And all of them sort of end up getting together and they get intertwined in this situation. And they all end up in M. Bison's secret lair where they have to fight baddies and then M. Bison. And then there's like a lot of military stuff going on. There's a lot of explosions, a lot of shooting, not much fighting. And then there's also a genetically altered man. And that is sort of the general gist of it. The big question is, who is the main character of this film? Is it Colonel Guile?
Colonel.
Or is it
Colonel Guile?
Ryu and Ken.
Like, I know the answer.
Do you?
But it's the wrong answer. The main character is Guile. Because he is Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah.
And he has the big fight with the main baddie.
Yes.
So he is the main character. But really, he's not.
So we've read up about this film in different corners. I've read in my book. Neil has read this incredible article online.
Yeah, we'll put the link to the Polygon article. That it's a very fun read, where the journalist has gone and he's talked to basically everybody that's been involved. Not everybody, but most of the people involved in the film, like behind the scenes and on screen. And just compiled like this very interesting retelling of how this film was made. But first off, good day.
Yeah.
Did you like this film?
No. I kept thinking throughout, maybe this would be way better if someone else was here with me. If I wasn't alone watching this film, it might actually be properly enjoyable. I did laugh out loud twice in a moment that they had, like, it was a joke and it worked for me.
Yeah.
But overall, I found it really long-winded. I found it lacking in any meaningful action, and it was just overcrowded. And I remember I saw it as a kid, and even then, with no taste, I thought, what the hell was that? So, yeah, not a huge fan of this film. How about you?
I love this movie.
What?
I love this movie, Goodney.
What are you talking about? Why?
It is not a good film.
No.
No, it is not a good film. But I am so glad it exists. I love this movie. Now, I saw this movie for the first time when I reckon I was like 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
Must have been, because I think my brothers went to see it at the cinema and I couldn't go because mm-hmm. I wasn't old enough, or they had rented it and I wasn't allowed to watch it because my parents didn't. No, I must have been 6 anyway, because I think they recorded it off the TV or mm-hmm, we got to rent mm-hmm. it or whatever. So I got to watch it for my birthday. Now when I was about 6 or 7, was obsessed with like the army, mm-hmm. but not like the real army, like movie army. So like I thought Jean-Claude Van Damme's like military uniform was like the coolest. I loved Guile from The Game.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted that buzz cut kind of haircut that he had.
Which Jean-Claude does not have in this film. Which Jean-Claude,
yeah, because you are not touching Van Damme's hair. yeah, and I remember watching it as a kid and I was very young and just being like, wow, you know, mm-hmm, it's my birthday. Mm-hmm. I'm watching Street Fighter, a film that in the UK, it's a 12. So I shouldn't be watching this movie, mm-hmm. but I am.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, it was a thrill, a real thrill. And I had watched it once or twice since and was like, yeah, this is crap. But but it's mad. It's so mad. And
it really is.
It's really funny at times. I laughed out loud like 3 or 4 times, which is more than I've laughed out loud watching like comedies that people like. Like Christopher Nolan says that Talladega Nights is like his favorite comedy film,
mm-hmm.
one of his favorite films. I didn't laugh once watching that film, Goodney. I laughed 4 times. At least 4 times watching Street Fighter last night. It is a good time movie.
The joke that got me was, so there's a character called Zangief in this film, who is this giant mm-hmm. Russian guy with a mohawk.
Yes.
And who's just yep. an idiot. And he is, yep. he knows what film he's in and he's all in that.
Yes.
They're in this tent and they open up this closet and there's a TV inside with Chun-Li telling them like, oh, there's a car coming with explosives to blow your tent up. And they see on the screen that this car is coming, and Zangief in a panic shouts at them, change the channel. And then the car obviously comes and crashes into the tent and blows it all up. I thought that was great. That was a great joke.
The biggest laugh that I gave it, there was a time later on, but I can't remember what it was. But the first time I properly was like, I got caught off guard and I laughed, was they fake Guile's death.
Yeah.
And then Bison is watching like a news report of it. And they're like, you know, Colonel Guile is dead. And one of his henchmen is like, who's like this Jamaican guy. And I can't remember.
His DJ.
He's like, oh, you'll be happy about that, boss. And then Bison gives like this little monologue about how it's a great shame. You know, is he happy? No, I mourn. And then DJ just goes, okay. And I laughed hard, Goodney.
DJ's accent is all over the place in this film, by the way. It is sometimes Jamaican and sometimes not.
Yeah.
Yeah, Street Fighter is all about, like, every character is from a different country and they're sort of mm-hmm. borderline a stereotype from that country, you know, to different degrees. There is someone in this film that I didn't even know was in Street Fighter who's called Thunderhawk, who is like a Native American guy, I guess, who has like a bandana.
Oh, hit. Okay.
The guy with a bandaid on his head for most of the film, like a little plaster.
Yeah. Yeah. It's when they arrive at the temple.
Mm-hmm.
Then
he puts on there, then he assumes the bandana.
And then, and then in a wide with some ADR, Jean-Claude Van Damme's like, hey, what's with the hairband? And he's like, oh, it's a thing for good luck. And then Jean-Claude's like, well, you should have brought three.
Yeah. So Jean-Claude, while making this film, is like heavily on cocaine.
Off his tits.
And one of the reasons he signs up for this film is that he wanted to, you know, he's done a lot of kind of bloody...
wanted to buy more cocaine. That's why he did this movie.
Well, he wanted to get to like a lower, you know, like a younger audience, essentially, to, you know, broaden his appeal. Yeah. Because that
worked for Stallone in Stop or My Mum Will Shoot. Might come after. Who knows?
And he signs the contract with the caveat that he is the main character. However, he does not want to be on set for the entire thing. So his main character cannot be like there for most, like for all of it, like a main character mm-hmm. would be, which explains a lot. So suddenly they had to sort of elevate the other characters to try to make up for the lack of guile.
So, according to other sources, the Polygon article, which, mm-hmm. you know, quotes the great man Steven himself and the second unit director, who's also the stunt coordinator. The reason Giles barely in this film is because Goodney, he was off his tits on cocaine. So wouldn't be on set. It just so happened every morning he'd be like, I can't come in, I'm sick.
Mm.
Goodney, he was sick on cocaine. No, I don't know that for a fact. I don't know for the fact. I am joking. But apparently a lot of it is to do with just like he's not there, so they have to do something else.
Yeah, JCVD is incredibly difficult and volatile. He has apparently an affair with Kylie Minogue on set, who plays a character called something Cammy. Oh yeah, she's Cammy. Yeah, goes to show. I know these characters, but these people are not really the characters.
Yes.
What I found so funny about this film is how everyone has a job. All of these characters have jobs, and those jobs have nothing to do with what they do in the games. Like Chun-Li is a reporter. She has two tech guys with her. One is the boxer and the other one is the sumo guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just tech guys. They're like legit tech guys. She's a legit reporter. You know?
Yeah.
Guile is a real colonel, which is fair enough. But I just thought it was so funny. Like everyone can't just be there. They have to be there for a reason. And the reason is that they have a job to do. What is their job? I don't know. Dalzim, he is a scientist now. Okay, sure. Whatever.
That bit at the end where everything's blowing up and gone on fire, and then he appears without any hair.
Yeah,
and because dressed.
Because he's bald in the game.
And dressed in that character's like outfit where he's been wearing like a lab coat for the whole thing, and he's had hair for the whole thing. And then he appears at the end looking exactly like the character from the game. I was like, how do I not remember this? How has this happened? I don't remember that scene where like he loses his hair.
Also, there is no scene of him losing his hair. He just like in the heat of the moment, he's lost his hair. But I hadn't realized until you're saying it now, obviously, that like they're playing, the wardrobe department is playing the long game with Dalzim's costume, because he has a chain around his neck, like a ring around his neck to keep him from escaping because they're holding him hostage.
Yeah, that's right.
The character of Dalzim just wears underwear essentially and has a ring around his neck. Oh, of course.
Yeah.
That is funny. That is very clever.
Clever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A big thing that I know the article probably mentioned is the Snow White and the Seven Dwarves thing, where Capcom is pushing for, let's have everyone from Street Fighter 2 in the film, which are, 12 players, I think, 12 characters. And Steven is saying, you can't, like, try to name all seven dwarves. Try to name seven Star Wars characters, you know, try to name seven something. And they can't. And he goes like, well, yeah, because seven is basically the magic number. You cannot, you know, have more than that if you're talking about main characters. But then throughout extensive rewrites, Capcom kept pushing in more and more and more and more. And eventually you end up with this completely bloated cast.
What the article says is that it does the maths, basically, or Steven has done the maths. And it's like, with all the characters that they've had to include, I think it's like 15 or something, which equates to about 6 minutes of screen time per character.
Mm.
Which is, yeah, when you put it like that, it's like, that's nuts.
Yeah, but
like, that's nuts.
Yeah, but then you end up taking sort of shortcuts by putting multiple people in the same scene, even though they don't say anything, maybe, or just stand there or whatever.
Yes.
Like the Thunderhawk guy who doesn't do anything for like 80% of the film, and then he suddenly shows up at the end with a bandana on his head. I mean, there's so much to say. Like, you need to read this article and just read up on it, because it's so funny. There's so many weird things.
A couple of highlights for me, which after watching the film and then reading the article, all sort of started to make a bit more sense. Mm-hmm. Is that, yeah, first of all, Kylie Minogue only cast like moments before they film. And it's to do with, like, because they're shooting in Australia, they want the unions on side, they want, you know, everybody's to be happy. So they want to get a star. And, you know, what I forget, because her performance makes you forget, is that she was an actor before she was a pop sensation.
Yeah, on Neighbours.
Yeah, so, but watching the film, you would never have guessed. So there's that Capcom, they cast their Ryu/Ryu.
I think it's supposed to be Ryu, but this film just goes hard on the Ryu.
So the Polygon article addresses that. That'll be my third thing about this. So they cast that character, the, like, Steven and the gang. Byron Man, he's cast.
Byron Man. I am Byron Man.
I didn't even realize that. Anyway, that's his name. They cast him, but Capcom cast an actor who has basically played Ryu in Street Fighter adverts. So that's who they want. So Steven has to compromise. So he gets to keep his Ryu, but then they create this new character. And so one of the soldiers is that guy. And he's the guy who there's a scene in the film where he speaks Japanese to another character and they're speaking Japanese. And I remember thinking in that moment, why are these two characters speaking Japanese? Mm-hmm. And then they look at the monitor. Ah, of course, this is why they're speaking Japanese, because we immediately get a Godzilla parody.
Yes, exactly. You're talking about Kenya Sawada, who is playing a character called Captain Sawada, who was created for him
to have him in the film. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing that I'll say from the article is, we'll probably actually mention more, is the Ryu Ryu thing. Mm-hmm. Because I think the actual pronunciation is Ryu.
Okay.
But the actor, I think the actor that played Ken was struggling to say it. And in a moment of just like frustration, Stephen E. D'Souza goes, just say Ryu.
Mm-hmm.
So he does. And that's it. That's why Western audiences for years just called him Ryu. Because of one split decision made on the set. Yeah.
That's wild. There was this very funny thing, just one last thing about this, was the I mean, this whole thing was done in a very short time, by the way. Like, they hired in Steven, and we're talking about like a year, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is wild. And especially with all these rewrites and you know, all this cocaine. Mm-hmm. They were shooting in Thailand. They were shooting in Australia.
3 weeks. 3 weeks into filming, they are 10 days behind.
Yeah. That's like Tropic Thunder level, you know, stuff. And like Jean-Claude was so difficult. Like, he was shooting one scene and he, you know, there were blood squibs and this and that. So a big, like, big important shot. And then he would end with saying, like, you know, I'll see you later. And then they shot it. And then he came to Steven and just like, we got to do it again. Steven's like, why? It's like, I didn't see you later. I said, see you later. Because I saw, like, across behind the camera, there was a ladder and someone was moving it. So we have to do it again. And Steven, like, good Lord. And he was convinced, like, the sound guys as well, like, he did not say ladder. But Jean-Claude was so self-conscious about his pronunciation, people were always making fun of him. So they go, play it back. Sure enough, he says, later. It's fine. But he, anyway, he pushes, let's do it again. And in that one, see you later.
Yeah. So the film.
The film. Goodness. The film.
The film.
Right.
My first note was made within seconds. And my note is just, films just don't start like this anymore. It's like Van Damme, Julia, Street Fighter. And then the film begins. And it's just like, it's very similar to like the thing I loved most about Mortal Kombat, the film, where it just screams, Mortal Kombat! And then...
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I enjoy it when a film goes hard right at the start.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that.
It has won me over already.
Yeah. They give us some information on a news kind of reel from different stations saying, Shadaloo, you know, it's going crazy. He's got hostages. Bison's really done it this time. He wants $20 billion. But thankfully, Colonel Guile is on the case or whatever. And we cut to a scene where I think is it the first scene of the film where the assassin tries to kill Guile?
I'll be honest, I can't remember.
I wrote down this was the worst assassin I've ever seen because he, like, they're in.
They're serving coffee.
Yeah. And this guy is like, he's just serving coffee. And then he goes, ah, like pulls out a knife, jumps on the table. Jean-Claude kicks him off the table. No problem. You know, it is what it is. I thought, oh, okay, he's poisoning the coffee or he's poisoning the water, you know. That's how he's going to assassinate. Nope, he's going to pull out a knife and scream. That's what he's going to do.
Yeah, no, you're right. My memory of this film, even though I watched it last night, is all jumbled up. But yeah, at the beginning of the film is that, and then there's they talk to Bison.
Yes, on the news. Yeah, because Guile is just in the street because Chun-Li is on the case. Reporter Chun-Li and her two best friends are on the case. They go, Colonel Guile, do you have a message for... And Bison. Bison's watching TV, obviously, on his mega screens. Mm-hmm. And he somehow responds by taking over the network or something so he can chat with Guile.
He hacks in.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing that always confused me as a kid. So he's got some of the hostages in the room with him, Bison.
In a pit.
And then for some reason, I don't know if Guile sees his friend Carlos in the room.
No, he says something like,
but
you know.
But he's like, hostages, we're coming for you. Stay strong. You hear me, Charlie?
I'm coming for you. Yeah.
And then what's confusing is Bison goes over to him and looks at like his name tag or something like that and says, Carlos, come with me, Charlie, or something like that. And as a kid, I was like, what? Well, his name's Carla. Yeah, like, what's his name?
He makes the leap of logic of, you know, he figures it out. Like, oh, his nickname is Charlie because his name is this. But I didn't think those two names... Like, you don't call someone Charlie if his name is like, Carlos or whatever that was.
Yeah. Maybe it's just like ignorance on our part. And maybe it's like a commonly known thing that, like, you know, people who are called Carlos will get called Charlie. But it would be like for audiences around the world watching a Scottish street fighter and Jean-Claude's like, don't worry, Tosh, we're coming for you. And then he walks over to the guy and sees that his name is Douglas. And he goes, ah, Douglas, come with me, Tosh. Audiences around the world would be very confused. But in Scotland, for reasons I don't even know.
It's Tosh.
Tosh is short for Douglas.
Huh.
Hello there, dearies. This is Margaret, popping in from the Hoch Wiescht Department of Scottish Cultural Association. I'm just popping by to say that Neil's talking absolute tosh. Tosh does not mean Douglas. It means Donald. I dinna ken what the boy was thinking. Anyway, back to those bald pros with their funny wee takes on funny wee films. Okay, the new.
The more you know.
Yeah. The more you know, Goodney, the less you know.
Yeah. Tosh is taken along. Simply out of spite, Bison puts him in a Clockwork Orange-esque.
I was going to say Captain America thing.
With a Clockwork Orange on his head, of showing him violent images and injecting him with green and orange liquid, mm-hmm. Which is totally legit and totally real. And like, that's science. And Dr. Dalsim, because everybody has a job in this film, is supervising this with a metal ring around his neck. He is forced to do this. He's actually a good guy. And for the next 3 days, this guy, who's now named Blanca, because his last name was Blanca, grows in muscle sort of mass and becomes like a big old monster with red hair, which is very funny. Yes. And when he finally gets out and is just, you know, grabs onto Jean-Claude, and Jean-Claude's like, Charlie, it's me. Blanca's just like, I'm a monster. It's so stupid.
So I just remembered that my actual first laugh is in the scenes that come after. So we've got this establishing the hostages, blah, blah, blah. And then we meet Ken and Ryu, who go into the underworld, the CD underworld of this place, of Shadaloo. And they meet Sagat, who they are selling arms to. Now, we'll get onto the confusing part about the arms deal. But the joke that made me laugh was Sagat says, and somebody says to him, like, don't you know there's a curfew? And he says, nobody tells me anything. And then a loud helicopter flies past and like the spotlight comes in and it just goes like, curfew, now in force. and it was at this point that I remembered like, yeah, I remember upon a rewatch after seeing this for the first time as a kid, that there are loads of like jokes like this throughout where the tannoys are basically full on airplane. You know, like the white zone is for loading only thing. They go there. It's basically like they probably had the film made and Steven's like, oh man, like this isn't what I hoped for. And then they kind of do like a Whedon pass and they just decide to add in like these jokey tannoy announcements to kind of like give it a bit more, you know, a bit more fun. Potentially.
Like there are a lot of things like that. And the news is carrying a lot of the exposition. We cut to the news quite a lot.
I'm going to say if this film wasn't made, Starship Troopers wouldn't exist.
Wow. Okay. Bold claim. Ryu and Ken, I liked them. I liked them in this film. I thought they were charming. They were funny goofballs who are just scamming these arms dealers around the place. I got heavy Double Dragon vibes from them.
Yes.
Heavy Double Dragon vibes.
Yep. And really, they sort of have a story as well, which...
Yes. Which is more than most people can say in this film.
It's not fully successful, but basically Ken's arc is that he keeps being like, I'm just a hustler who's just out for himself. But then his friend has the opposite thing where he starts a hustler and then he sort of starts to believe in something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. The cause.
Yeah. And then they all come good because Ken's like, you know, you're my friend. I'll stand by you.
I felt in the end, obviously it wouldn't happen because it's, you know, the time it is made and the characters they are and all that, blah, blah, blah. But I felt in the end that they should have just ended up as a couple. Like, I felt like they clearly love each other quite a lot and they get along and they kind of break apart a little bit and then they come back together. And like, I don't know. I felt something there.
I'm just going to say this now, Goodney. This film is disgustingly woke. Okay. It's disgustingly woke.
In what
the
way?
The cast is so diverse.
Incredibly.
It makes me want to puke.
Yeah.
It's all about, like, the UN saving the world from, you know, hardworking capitalists, okay? All Bison wants to do is create bison land, right? All he wants is like a giant shopping mall on this country that he wants to run. And he wants to make a lot of money by having McDonald's come in. Okay? That's all he wants, Goodney. And then the UN come busting down his door.
Crazy.
And yeah. Electrocute him.
Electrocute him. Well, he electrocutes himself, sort of. Raul Julia has stomach cancer right before they, like an operation right before they start shooting the film. So mm-hmm. he arrives and he's just the shadow of himself, like weight wise. And they've made this giant costume for him. And like everything you find about this film, everybody says the same thing. Like Raul Julia was just incredible. Like what an actor, like acted, you know, till the very end. So every time the cameras are on, he's just a completely different beast, but he's clearly like in a lot of pain and under weight and all that. Mm-hmm. He is here to like act in a kid's film, I would say. Like he is here to like fully ham it up. And what a weird screen pair, him and Jean-Claude.
Yes.
What a weird pair.
But he's really good in this. Like, he doesn't have, when it comes to the final fight, it sort of maybe is a bit lacking. For obvious reasons, but throughout, like his little monologues, you know, because he's got the full sort of,
he's got the best line in the film, and in a terrible film,
I disagree.
This is an incredible line.
I know what you're going to mention, Goodney, and I disagree because he contradicts himself. The implications of his line contradict. Like the point of his message.
The line. Well, there's a lot of about him that is contradicting. You know, he keeps being like, oh,
he's a very complicated character.
I want one-on-one fights. That's all about honor. And then he, like Chun-Li just like kicks his ass and he mm-hmm. runs away. And then he fights Guile at the end and he's terrible at it and he cheats a lot. But anyway, so he says to Chun-Li, because it turns out she has become a reporter because he came and killed everyone in her village and killed her father or something ages ago. And she tells him about this and he's just like, I don't remember any of this. And then he says the line, which is something along the lines of, you know, the day M. Bison graced your village with his presence, it was the most important day of your life. But for me, it was Tuesday. And it's such a such a good line. It's such a mic drop moment.
I don't know. I'd be like, Bison, you're pretending that you don't remember, but you clearly remember that happened on a Tuesday.
It's not necessarily Tuesday, Neil. It's such a good line.
No, it is.
And
it
also
is
her face afterwards, just, you know.
Yeah.
What I thought sort of afterwards was thinking kind of like, you know, what would I have liked at the time, what would I want now, today, to see in a Street Fighter film? Mm-hmm. And the main thing is just great fighting. That's the main thing mm-hmm. I would want from a Street Fighter film. The second would be the characters that I know and love. And mm-hmm. basically, if you have these two things and they're done well, that's enough. And I would argue that in this film, these characters, most of them have nothing to do with what these characters are in the game. They just kind of look like them. And the fighting is extremely lackluster. And it's also just sparse. So, like, there's not a lot of fight mm-hmm. scenes in this. There's more gunplay than fighting. Like, Ken shoots Guile in the stomach with a fake bullet.
Not to drag us back, but can we just speak very briefly about this arms deal? Because I am extremely confused by it.
Yeah.
They do the arms deal and they get the money and they go to leave. And then Sagat's like, no, wait, look, well, you know, we know where you stored it. We went and took it and now we have it. Mm-hmm. And then they shoot them.
Yes.
But little Nerf ball things come out.
Yeah.
Now I'm confused here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Is it A, that's what Sagat ordered? Mm-hmm. B, Sagat knew that they had been cheated and gave them fake guns. And, you know, now they're going to shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
And show them that he knows that and that they're trying to con him. Is it C, Sagat's playing a prank on them and he is using these fake guns to, like, mess with them?
Mm-hmm.
Because they pull out the guns and everybody's terrified.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Ken and Ryu, they're both, like, scared. To the point where then they pull the trigger, they kind of, like, they flinch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the balls come out. And everybody is shocked. Everybody is shocked. But somebody in that room knows that these guns don't work.
So I think...
it's very confusing.
Sagat knows. That's my theory. Sagat knows, and the guys mm-hmm. with the guns, they all know. I think Ryu and Ken, they are also aware, but they are faking the flinching because, you know, all the way to the end, they are going to maintain composure and maintain the scam. I think the reason that Sagat and the guys pulling the trigger know is that these mm-hmm. guns, the barrels... like, this must be like a rocket launcher, essentially, a grenade launcher, because a tennis yeah. ball comes out. So
yeah.
they wouldn't be doing this in such close proximity indoors unless mm-hmm. they knew this was fake. That's yeah. what I think.
Fair enough. Fair enough. It's just, as the scene played out, I started to think about it. I'm trying to figure out the logic of it all, and I just couldn't make it make sense.
Street Fighter, make it make sense.
But you ask, like, what film would you want for Street Fighter? And do you know what? I want, like, this film.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, I want the fighting to be better.
Yeah.
And maybe a bit more frequent. But on the face of it, like, it's a fun idea.
There's a lot of fun things going on in this. And Steven, when he pitched the idea of, you know, Bison, Warlord, military action, kind of G.I. Joe-y, mm-hmm. he was doing that to be different from, you know, the other pitches, because he only had a couple of days to come up with the pitch for Capcom. So he assumed, everybody's going to go for a tournament film, but I'm not going to go for a tournament film. I'm going to do something different. The reason for the sort of shoddy fighting is sort of twofold.
Yes.
One, Raul Julia shows up and he's so skinny and they don't want to do his close-ups yet. So they push the drama stuff way back. And instead, they expedite the fighting, which was supposed to take place way later and be planned way more. So nobody has time to practice properly and they just show up to set. Some actors were showing up to set like without having rehearsed at all. And then mm-hmm. they were just supposed to do a fight scene with a fight choreographer. So there's that. And the second was the rating. First time they put the film into the rating board, they get a like PG-16. PG-18 or 16.
They get an R. They get an R.
An R, sorry. And that like contractually, that was, Steven couldn't have that. Like he had to deliver a PG-13 film.
Mm-hmm.
You have like three shots, I think, of putting it to the board, and you don't get an explanation of why it got an R. So you just have to guess. Mm-hmm. So they got a second R, and then they managed to get it down to a PG-13 by removing a bunch of fight stuff and a bunch of blood stuff.
According to legend mm-hmm. / the legend, Stephen E., they put in the edit, and it got a G. So they went from an R down to G.
Yeah.
And then they were like, we need a PG-13. So then they shoot an ADR line of Jean-Claude saying, I am too old for this shit, which then bumps up to PG-13.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. You can tell that this film has been edited beyond an inch of its life. It has been pieced together in chaos. Like
so much chaos.
There are leaps in the story. Like, so we have Chun-Li and her gang with their terrible plan. I'm assuming she's trying to kill Bison by, you know, driving that truck into the tent to blow it up.
Yes. Well,
but she telegraphs it. She telegraphs it so much.
Isn't she just trying to blow up the weapons or something?
So yeah, but just kill him. But so they escape. Cut to, we're in Bison's lair. Chun-Li and her companions are captured. I don't remember that happening. Again,
it's the gas. It's the gas. When he escapes from the room.
No. Before that, Goodney. They're in the tent. They've blown it up.
Oh, yeah.
We cut to another scene, and we cut to then Bison's lair, and everybody's handcuffed, including Chun-Li and Honda and, is it Balrog?
Balrog, the boxer, yeah. Wow, yeah, now that you mention it, I don't remember them being captured.
Yeah, how do they get captured? Nobody knows.
We don't need to see the person open the door, close the door, get in the room. We just need to see them in the room, you know?
Yeah.
That's filmmaking, baby.
Well, you say that, but then I think another kind of great example of this film is just being thought up on the spot. It's been pieced together. They're just troubleshooting everything is Guile's faked his death.
Yeah.
Chun-Li has discovered that there's a homing beacon.
Yeah, she puts a homing beacon on the truck to follow the escaped prisoners, which is Sagat and Vega. Yeah. Ryu and Ken. Ryu and Ken are undercover as bad guys with Sagat who will take them to Bison.
Yes. So she follows the signal.
Because there's a separate signal. Yeah.
Yeah, which leads to, that's it. Because they pick up the frequency and it's bouncing back to somewhere nearby. So they follow that signal.
To a morgue.
She follows it. she follows into this building. We get this great shot. I'm going to pause it. A really nice shot of her going down the stairs. Like she comes in the window. One shot on the crane. We have a guy going up the stairs and then she jumps down to avoid him. And it's nice. She then goes into the thing that's then signed morgue. And as soon as I saw morgue, I immediately thought like the logic that they're going to employ here is going to make absolutely no sense. The scene will make no sense. I know what's going to happen and I don't understand why it would play out like this. So she goes into the morgue and she's kind of creeping around. And then we've got empty like places where bodies would be laid down. And then we see a body bag. And then next to it is a monitor that's beeping.
Yeah.
And it's got like the map on it. And she walks over to it and she's like, And then she unzips the thing and it's dead Guile. And she's like, And then she zips it back up. And then Guile immediately sits up and it's like, ah. And she's like, ah. And then he unzips. And then he takes off like his shirt to show that blood squibs.
Yeah.
And it's like, none of this makes any sense as to why it's happening like this. Like if you sat and you thought about it for a second, I mean, they probably did. And they're like, we don't care. But
Because also like he was shot during the day. This is during the night. He's been lying there in a body bag for like 12 hours waiting for her to show up.
Exactly.
To then be able to go, bah, I'm actually alive.
And then and only then, you know, take off his blood squibs, maybe change his shirt.
And immediately, like, and
it's so wild.
And immediately, Kylie Minogue and Thunderhawk come running in. Kylie Minogue in this film, by the way, she ain't good, man.
No, she's awful. She's awful.
Yeah.
But apparently, one of the reasons that she is cast is because of her past in soaps. You know, there you have to learn lines like the night before the day off, and you just parrot them. And because of the tight turnaround, they were just like, that's perfect. She just needs to learn a line and then say it.
Yeah.
She is also given like nothing. She's given nothing to do.
Yeah. But when you have so many characters, someone's going to end up having nothing, you know, at the end of it, especially when you're trying to make everybody like look the part, you know, like look how they're supposed to and all that. There's a scene that made me laugh, which is Bison has Chun-Li sort of like brought to his room to sort of
just before his whole like it was a Tuesday line.
Yeah, exactly. He is charming her by, you know, showing her his cool gadgets and stuff like that. And
he wants to seduce her.
And he's painting. And the painting is terrible. Like it's so bad. It reminded me a little bit of that scene in Far Cry when the creepy doctor is painting something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's like painting, and then we finally see it and like, oh, that's crap. what's this?
Maybe Uwe was paying tribute to Street Fighter.
Maybe.
Um,
That made me laugh a lot. And that scene where, you know, because she suddenly just like breaks her chains and just kicks his ass. And obviously, like, Raoul isn't in the best of shapes and all that, but like M. Bison in the games is an extremely capable opponent, extremely dangerous and like very strong. And yeah, sure, he has like the electronic gadgets and stuff like that. Like he can fly with his boots and stuff, which he does in this film, but he could actually hold his own. So the fact that
he does later in the film when he's fighting Guile one-on-one,
barely
he holds his own for a bit, and then basically Guile only beats him by accident by kicking him into like a machine which then electrocutes him.
Well, he kicks him into the TVs, I think.
No, that's how he kills him, or does he? It's the bit before that where like he kicks him and then he lands on top of some computer unit. There's like a little explosion thing, and then he kind of just lies there. And then the computer thing in his suit gives him CPR, which brings him back to life. And then he starts using his little electrical conductor things, gauntlets.
And his boots, yeah.
So the reason I love this film, okay, I feel like I do have to justify it, because it's like it's chaos. It's just chaos on the screen, but it's also chaos on the screen that's got a lot of kind of like talent behind it. So maybe because we were watching kind of like a remastered, I assume it's maybe the remastered one that we watched on, because I think there's like a 4K version of this or something.
Okay.
But a lot of it I felt looked nice. Like it has that 90s gloss to it. I mean, I think it's on the lower end of the budget of those type of blockbuster films. But, you know, the location stuff, when they're outside like that temple, you know, it's very nice looking. You've got the speedboat stuff, you know, it's pretty cool. The costumes are great.
Can we talk about the speedboat moment where Jean-Claude decides to drive the speedboat on his own, despite the UN telling him, don't do it. He takes all the soldiers with him. He goes on the speedboat and he puts in a cassette.
It's not even a cassette. It's like a Betamax, like, video thing.
And I thought, he's going to play some music. No, he's got a video of Blanca, Carlos, Charlie, Tosh.
It's not Tosh. Tosh was my example.
Yeah, I know that, but, you know, purposes of the podcast.
Car Tosh
is there with his family, just having a good old time. And we see it on a little screen in the boat, which he watches while driving. And I was flabbergasted.
Again, it's another one of these scenes where, as it's playing, I'm immediately confused by everything, because we get this call to arms speech. We get them all on the thing. We get him in his speedboat, his really cool super spy speedboat. And then we cut to the speedboat and there's a song playing, a really cheesy song. Now, this is new. This hasn't happened before in the film. So when we then cut into the speedboat, I'm wondering, is this playing in the speedboat?
Is it diegetical? Yeah.
And then I get confused because then we see him bring out basically a cassette. And I'm like, wait, is he going to put music on? But there is a song playing. And there's not really been a song playing at any other time in this film.
Yeah.
And then he puts it in. Yeah. And then it flickers on and we see Jean-Claude, a woman, and Carlos. But bearing in mind, it's been about 60 minutes since we saw Carlos's face, I didn't immediately recognize that as Carlos.
Yeah.
So I was like, wait, has Jean-Claude got a wife that he's like pining for, that he's longing for, that is dead, that he's divorced from?
He's pining for his friend and his wife.
And the shot is very brief and there's no dialogue in it. It's just them like laughing and being happy. And then we cut away.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's confusing.
I mean, obviously the point of the scene is like, oh, he's about to meet Carlos.
Why is
enough,
it not a flashback?
Don't you carry around a tape of me that you can watch at any moment if you get nostalgic?
Yeah. Like, and the build up to this and the plan for that, what they're doing is they're going on a very dangerous mission, and they're like a mad, somebody out of their mind. Somebody who's going to lead this charge has to have lost their mind. And then Guile says, I'm so fed up of Guile. He's made me lose my mind. So I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So he's in this super spy speedboat.
Invisible.
The hero. And I don't know if he's invisible yet. That's also confusing. So he's on this like dangerous mission and he decides to watch a video. At least if it was a flashback, it's kind of just like,
yeah,
he's thinking about like, what am I fighting for?
Yeah.
You know, give us like a hearts on fire moment from Rocky IV, you know, when Sly's like driving and it's like, yeah. And he's thinking about Drago and all that. Give us like something like that, but don't have him watch a video while he's driving really fast speedboat. But yeah, and then they're
It's irresponsible is what it is.
It is, guys. Kids, when you're driving, don't be distracted by other screens. Yeah, because then they're like, activate stealth mode. They pull down their little plastic visors. Then there's a little like thing of electricity. And we see the speedboat. And again, I don't know, maybe I blinked, but to begin with, it didn't look like there was any change to the speedboat.
No,
we could see it.
No, you're right. And at some point we cut back to it and it's invisible
and it's invisible.
Kind of almost like
a mirror. Once they've engaged stealth mode, nothing happens. So again, I was confused.
Well, Bison sees them on the screen. He sees like the water moving, but there's no boat.
Yeah,
so he goes, there they are.
It's shooting missiles and it's blowing things up in stealth mode. Surely you'd be able just to go, look, see where the missiles come out of. I think there might be something there.
Yeah. A positive for me is Vega, the guy with the three claws. He is exactly how Vega should be. Super vain. Very good looking, insanely muscular, but lean. He's almost like a matador or something. And always with his mask, like even the costume, like all of that, I felt worked 100%. And the performance that the guy was doing worked for that character.
As a kid, like my go-to characters when playing Street Fighter were Sagat and Vega. I liked Guile because of his army outfit, but they were like joint sort of favorites. And I remember being confused, slightly distressed at this film because they were bad guys. And I didn't like that.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at his name. Wes Studi, who plays Sagat. Like, you know, you have a lot of talent on screen. Like he's a really good actor. He's one of those like actors that you see pop up in loads of films and he's a reliable presence. So I enjoyed him as Sagat.
A thing about this film, structurally, which I think if we just go down to the bare bones of it, which bothers me, is that...
I know what you're going to say, Goodney.
Yeah.
Why is there an aquarium in the lab? I don't know. That's my answer.
Yeah, that's the structural question I have. I feel like there is no act two in this entire film.
Correct.
Hear me out. When abouts in the script do you think they infiltrate his base, M. Bison's base? Like when is, Chun-Li and the gang, not Guile, but everybody else, are they there?
I know the answer because I paused it to reply to a message and saw that we still had like an hour left of this film. And Guile is telling off the plan of them invading the base.
Yeah. So the big, like, you know what? The UN is telling us to back off, but, you know, who wants to go with them and who wants to go with me? And everybody's
like, it's time to cancel the apocalypse.
Yeah, exactly. That happens when there's more than an hour left of the film. Like, there's less than half of the film done when we are doing the big, you know, this is our Independence Day speech, which is insane. And I know they had to shoot a bunch of like extra stuff to shoot around the fact that they didn't have Jean-Claude or whatever. He apparently took the actors without telling anyone to Hong Kong one weekend, and then they got stuck there. So they had to like have like the C team of actors doing some extra scene that they had to come up with on the fly. And I know that it's heavily edited and all that, but there's something really weird about this film structurally. Why do we go so early to Bison's Island? Why, like, or his hideout? Why are we not like, I don't know, because there's this tiny little middle bit where Sagat and Ken and Ryu and Chun-Li, so many people, and Vega gather in this tent to do like a weapons deal, Sagat and Bison, they disagree because Bison wants to pay him in Bison dollars instead of US dollars, which is quite funny. That thing I felt could have, I don't know, served as like a playing ground for half an hour of the film. That environment, the building up to that or something, I don't know. Even the prison break is so quick.
Yes.
It's so, they go into prison and they break out of prison immediately. So
their prison break is also stupid. They've got the key. They're, you know, they can get out at any time, but they decide to do it whilst still inside the compound, and have to get out of their car, out of the transport vehicle to then get into the front seat where there's like soldiers with guns.
Yeah.
So surely they should have just been shot on sight.
Well, they tried to, but they're like the worst shots ever. Or everybody has blanks, later. I don't know.
That happens only as they start to barrel towards the door, the gate, and they drive through it.
Yeah.
No, I agree.
But you know what I mean?
That there is, yeah.
They're engaging. It's the like the Batman Forever going to the whatever weird island the Riddler and Two-Face have at the end. Like, they don't do that in the middle of the film. They do that in the end, you know.
So, a couple of thoughts. And I think you probably know the answers yourself, is that, yeah, as you say, you've got the Jean-Claude problem of this unreliable lead. I think also the fact that they are forcing him to be the lead, like his character to be the lead, when, as you say, it's Ken and Ryu.
Yeah, because they have something like, to...
They're the leads.
They have something to learn. They have some way to grow.
Well, they also have the story. The story is that they are these, you know, hustlers who get involved in like this big war, basically, and then find themselves in the center of it all. They're having to go undercover to gain access to this warlord. Then they have to decide, you know, what side are they going to take? And then wants to take one side, one wants to take the other side, and then they all come good in the end. Like, that's a story.
Yeah,
Guile's story is nothing, man. Yeah, is that he's there, you know, basically losing the war. He continues to lose the war. And then he wins the war.
Yeah.
Like that's his story. So there's that. But I also think now, as some listeners will know, Goodney and I have a shared history with a job where we write scripts for a film class for kids. And one of the things we often smash our heads against the wall having to deal with is we're told, go write a short script. It's like 4 pages long. That all the actors can be involved in, like at all times. Oh, and by the way, there's 7 characters. And those 7 characters have to be in every single scene doing something all the time because we don't want anybody sitting doing nothing. And we weep. We weep into our final draft because that is a monumental task. They have something similar here where they have 15 characters that all need to be on screen at all times doing stuff. So yeah, let's get them to the bad guy's lair as quick as possible because that way we can justify story-wise them all to be in the room together.
Yeah.
Fighting and doing stuff.
I will give Steven that. He did manage to cram all of these people into the film. Mm-hmm. And in a way... their presence makes sense thanks to those weird-ass jobs that he gave everybody. So I will give him that. He managed to do what they told him to do. And Capcom apparently were quite happy with the film, all things considered, even though critics weren't, because it was a financial success. Other line that Zangief said that made me laugh was when DJ is making off with some money.
Yes.
And he says, what's DJ say? He says something like, you know.
DJ's like, you know, I don't get paid enough for this. Yeah, and then he runs away. And then Zangief turns to the camera and says,
You got paid?
Yeah. Zangief is good. And it's a classic character of like this muscle meathead guy who is, he's basically the Sweetums of Street Fighter. Mm. So Sweetums is the big guy in the Muppets, and in Treasure Island, you know, he saves Gonzo at one point, and they're like, why are you helping us? You're one of the bad guys. And he goes like, you kidding? I love you guys. And that's basically what happens in this film, where it's just, he's like, oh, wait, you know, I thought we were the good guys, but we're actually the bad guys. Okay, now I'm going to be a good guy.
Yeah, he opens and everybody's like, holds the door open for them.
Everybody's cool with it. Nobody questions the timing of it.
No.
When it's all hit the fan, this guy turns coat.
Yeah.
And everybody's cool with it. So
there is a blink and you'll miss it Hadouken in this film.
Yes.
When Ryu is fighting Vega, he does a Hadouken, just like a flash.
Yes and no. So I thought it was just like a fun little, they put the flash in to be like, look, it's like he's doing a Hadouken. Because he basically just like double punches him in the stomach.
Yeah.
And then he sort of falls back.
I didn't catch if he says Hadouken or not when he does it.
I don't know. Maybe they took it out. Mm-hmm. The legend goes that he was supposed to do a Hadouken, but VFX time just wasn't there.
Mm.
So they couldn't have the Hadouken. I think not having it is better.
It would have just been weird in this film, because this film has a lot of stuff, but it does not have any magic in it.
Yeah.
Whereas I thought like a almost exactly the same thing, but
actually,
better.
Not true. What? Not true, Goodney.
What's the magic?
There is magic.
What's magic?
Where they put Chun-Li in the barrel and then they put it on Honda's chest.
When they're pretending to be magicians.
Balrog hits it with his big samurai sword and it's empty. That's magic.
Yeah.
That's magic, goodness.
A better but comparable scene is the finale in Mortal Kombat, where Liu Kang shoots a fireball into Shang Tsung's chest and knocks him off in the fatality.
Yes.
But that fireball, I keep being so impressed by it every time I see it. And the older I get, the more impressed I am with it, with the restraint. Like, it could have looked so bad if they would have had more distance to it. But instead, they kept him right against Shang Tsung. So he just like blasts him in the chest. And this is very similar, but it's just a weird flash of light. And I think people who don't know the game would just be very confused about it. But I think you could not have made a Street Fighter film without having some kind of Hadouken, I think.
Yes.
There is a Capcom controller at one point that Bison is using to try to blow up the invisible boat. There is, as you say, a Godzilla fight where we cut to like Honda and Zangief like fighting it out on top of the Bison, the model of the Bison city.
We have the other companion of Chun-Li, who is Balrog. He at some point dons full boxing regalia. He puts on...
We don't see him do that, by the way.
We don't see him do it. He just appears in one scene wearing bright purple silk clothes and really red boxing gloves.
Yeah.
It's a shock.
I've got one more thing, but that's about it.
Go for it.
The final frame of the film.
Same. That's exactly... So... This is why I love the film, Goodney. I would argue I wouldn't love it as much if it didn't have that final frame. Because it just highlights the sheer stupidity and chaos of this film. What is the shot, Goodney?
Well, the temple has exploded. Guile is dead. Everybody's sad. Even Zangief, who was evil 5 minutes ago. Smoke. Guile steps up. Oh my God, how did he survive? I don't know. He comes to us. And we exchange some lines. He flirts with Kylie Minogue. And then they all just sort of turn to camera and pose. Freeze frame.
Yeah.
Film's over. And the funny thing about the freeze frame is some people are in other people's way. Like quite quite extensively. Like, there's a hand in front of someone's face and everything. Mm. So it's a really weird shot to choose. But everyone's flexing and posing. It is so very funny.
And it's so aggressive as well. Yeah. Like, we've had, you know, we've got, like, the people basically wrapping up and, you know, doing bits. He flirts a little bit with Kylie, and then he flirts a little bit with Chun-Li, and he flirts a little bit with Zangief. You know, it's all it's all there. It's all very nice, very erotic. And then, like, they all kind of, like, laugh. And in my mind, for some reason, I thought the final frame was just, like, Jean-Claude, like, laughing and then giving, like, a big, like, you know, bicep thumbs up to the camera.
Yeah.
But it's so much better than that, good news. It's, yeah, it's literally just everybody, like, ha, ha, ha. Then, like, wah! Like, very aggressively, they all just strike a pose and turn to the camera, and then freeze frame, street fire, brrr, music.
Yeah.
Film's finished.
It's like another sort of, like, echo of this is in Mortal Kombat. The end of the first one is, like, Shao Kahn appears in the sky, goes like, ah, puny mortals, I've come for your souls. We cut to the fighters going, I don't think so. They all strike a pose, you know, cut to the amazing song again. But they have, like, something to react to. There's a man in the sky. Whereas here, nothing triggers this. Nothing triggers that. Like, everybody poses. Yeah. Which makes it even funnier.
And it's kind of like the film is at its best when it like with two hands grabs hold of, like, this idea that it's a cartoon, it's a live action cartoon. I think that's where this film works at its best, where you have Jean-Claude delivering, like, just ridiculous lines, where, like, you know, you've got Bison being like, you've made me a happy man, and he's like, no, I'm about to make you a dead one, and things like that. And then his speech about how, you know, they said war's over, let's pack up and go home. Well, I'm not going to do that. Like, and then you've got the Tannoy announcements. You've got them in their uniforms, all brightly colored, and you've got his, like, Cobra base, basically, and, like, Bison's Cobra base, and Zangief, even, like, Vega and Sagat, like, it embraces this cartoon element, which sometimes then gets lost. But it for me, it excels when it does that. And then that bit at the end just is one of those examples of just, like, what a ridiculous thing. But it made me smile, and it meant at the end of the film, I was smiling. But it's not the final frame. There's an after credit sequence.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't see that.
Yeah.
What's the after credits?
The after credit sequence is we cut back to Bison's lair. The camera sort of is moving over the wreckage, and the computer's voice is just like all sort of messed up and be like, rrr, 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 like, charging solar panels, rrr, rrr, charging solar panels, rrr, rrr. And then it's like, charging power, and then, like, power on, computer on. And then I can't remember what it is. There's something about Bison, and then a hand, like, of punches course, through the wreckage. Of course. Then the film's over. Like, it's a terrible film, but I love it.
But it's impressive, though, if they were planning on a sequel, to manage to make a whole film with all these characters and there's nothing but gunplay and fighting throughout the whole thing, and nobody actually died. So you can actually bring all of them back.
Not true. Vega dies. Vega is dead.
Wait, is he?
Yeah. So I didn't know this. And then I was reading the article on Polygon, and they were talking about making the cuts to get it to be PG-13. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they do is, you know, they're cutting out, like, so much to avoid showing bloody noses, avoid showing blood at any point. And what happens in the fight? So we see Vega's face being up against the
fire. Like a hot furnace fire. Or something, yeah.
Yeah. And now I can't tell you what happens after that. I can't remember, but no. I think what happened is that he falls, and he's supposed to fall on top of his
blades,
his blades. And then I think what we were supposed to see is, like, his blood basically, like, pouring out, and it's like Vega's dead. But because they cut all that, nobody really knows.
No, he could come back in a sequel. Technically,
but I think what shows you that he's dead though is that Sagat is out with DJ.
Yes, which confused me.
Yeah. So yeah, because Vega's dead.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and like Blanca and Dr. Dalsim remain in the
they're dead thing. They have to be dead.
But they could come back. They could come back.
True.
He's like, I need to stay here with my boy and repent. And we're like, you're bald now. What happened? Blanca is just, and then they stay in under the crumbling wreckage. So they made an animated series based off of this film, which ran mm-hmm. for, I don't know, 20-something episodes and was apparently terrible. Mm-hmm. And I'm so curious to see if they tried to make them look like, you know, Jean-Claude, or if they tried to make them look like the video game characters.
I reckon it'll be half and half.
Kind of like the video game, yeah.
So one of the things I do really like about it is the sort of the cheesy early 90s Saturday morning cartoon aesthetic and the vibe
get from this film. It is very G.I. Joe.
Yeah, I like that, mm-hmm. But it is a terrible film.
Yeah. So, question is, do you even want to fix this film?
Yeah. Let's fix it. I think the way I would fix it is give them more than a year to get it out, because they had a coveted Christmas slot that they had to reach, and so that was immovable. So with time, I think the fights would have been better. And as you say, that's what you want from a Street Fighter film. So you want better fights. Whether or not we would have got them from Hollywood in the early 90s, because they sort of struggled with hand-to-hand combat, shooting it in a good way, I don't know if we would have got that, but that's what you want. That's the only fix. That's the only fix, because to change anything else would you can make this film better, mm-hmm. but would it be as charming mm-hmm. as it is without that? Or would it just be boring? Would it just be bland?
Yeah, I respect it for not going down the tournament route.
Yes.
But I can see how a lot of people would have been disappointed by it not doing that. Then again, I'm not sure why the tournament is what it is in the games. You know, like in Mortal Kombat, it's quite clear what they're doing. In Tekken, it's clear what they're doing. Here, I'm really not so sure.
I think it's just as basic as, originally it was just as basic as they're just fighting. Like it's a world tournament. They're just seeing who's the best fighter in the world.
Yeah. If I'm trying to like really fix it, I would try to balance these three acts a bit more. Move all this final stuff over to the third act, put something much more interesting in the second act. You know, if you want to keep this stupid, like, oh, Jean-Claude is dead. Oh, no, he's not, you know, and Prison Break, Ken and Ryo need to infiltrate the bad guys, you know, whatever. You can keep that, but you could just give that more space.
Mm-hmm.
Way more fights, way better fights, way better fights. It doesn't even need to be like blood and gore. Not really. That's not Street Fighter. That's never been Street Fighter. Not really. Yeah. And then also pick your main character. Is it Jean-Claude Van Damme, perfect military man who everybody is hungry for and can do everything? Or is it these two douchebags that are...
It should be the douchebags. Yes, it should be the douchebags.
Absolutely. And the funny thing is, Ken and Ryu aren't like this at all in the games. Like this is completely new. Mm-hmm. them running guns for, you know, some punks, like that's not what they do.
Yeah.
So it's very funny. And it's also in the game, like Ryu and Ken, as you said, are the original ones. Like that sort of tells you these are the main characters of the series. Just like, you know, you have the Mishima family in Tekken and you have, you know, like Liu Kang in Mortal Kombat. It is quite clear who is the actual main character and who is side character. So to go with Guile just because, you know, we want Jean-Claude. That was actually... in the thing that I read, Capcom said, we got one demand, Jean-Claude Van Damme is Guile. So, because they had no idea, because they couldn't really understand English, they couldn't understand that he had a weird accent. Like they tried to explain it, but they just could not get it. So yeah, those are my basic fixes. Just Ryu and Ken are the main characters. It's their journey. And balance the acts a bit better, because it's a bit odd. It is really, like, you feel it, how odd it is, how fast we are in the finale.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
there's an hour left of this hour and 40 minute film.
Yes. Yeah.
Budget of the film, $35 million. The gross was just shy of 100. So it did make its money back, as opposed to Mario that came out a year earlier, I think, and did not do as good. So this is the early days, though, like, of video game adaptations. Nobody's doing them. So
this is the second adaptation, I believe,
in the West,
video game adaptation.
In the West, at least. So you have to sort of give them, you know, credit for that. They, you know, this hasn't been tried and tried and tried before. And technically, we could do a month of just Street Fighter stuff. We could, like, there's the Street Fighter, The Legend of Chun-Li, the sort of reboot that they did years later. There is the Street Fighter 2 animated film, which is apparently great. There is Street Fighter Assassin's Fist, the Machinima / Capcom web series that came out a few years ago, which I watched when it came out, based on a short film that these two guys who played Ryu and Ken did on their own and wanted to do a series. So there's a lot of Street Fighter stuff out there, but I think it would get very boring for all of you out there. So I'm not going to do that. But maybe we'll touch on all of those things eventually. And maybe we'll hunt down the actual game, Street Fighter, the movie, the game.
Yeah.
And test it at some point. Because I watched videos of it ages ago and was, a bit speechless.
Yeah.
The big thing here is this is episode 50, Neil. 50 Woo! Episodes. That's crazy. And it's supersized because it's Street Fighter and there's a lot to talk about. And, you know, it's a very silly little film. But yeah, 50 episodes.
50, yeah. It's been an honor.
A privilege. And this also, I guess the next episode marks the end of season 2 of A Bold Opinion, which will launch us into season 3, where it all takes off. Out of 5 Tuesdays, how many would you give this film?
Don't hate me. 3.
Wow.
Yeah.
Welcome to Neil City.
Hey, if you can give Double Dragon 3, I can give Street Fighter 3.
This is in the same vein as Double Dragon, although I would say Double Dragon is better. I mean, I get why. And I think if you watch it with your friends, this is probably somewhere between 2.5 and 3 stars. If you watch it on your own like I did, and not with the voices in my head like Neil did. this is like a 1-star film. Like, this isn't, like, it's a bad film. So I'm going to have to stick with one Tuesday on this one. I'm going to have to be rough. Right.
Sorry, no, you mispronounced wrong. it's pronounced wrong, not rough.
Having said that, I would rather watch this film again than a lot of the other stuff that we've watched for this podcast.
Oh, like 90%. Even films that I thought were good that we've watched for this podcast. And that's why I gave it 3, Goodney, because
you would watch it again.
Because I would watch it again. I probably wouldn't watch it again on my own. So Steven E. D'Souza is a legend. He's written been involved in the writing of so many legendary, like, Hollywood action films that, you know, even on an off day, there's like fun things in this, because he's like at the, you know, he's at the peak, or just on like on the downward bit of his peak, of his powers. And I think he's, you know, he's got lots of people involved because they want to be involved with him. They want to be involved in this project. So there's a lot happening in it where there's like good stuff, and it's visually crazy. It's just chaos, and like it's fun chaos, and not, you know, Silent Hill 2, whatever it was called, like chaos where it's just rubbish.
So are you going to go on the record right now and say that Street Fighter is better than Mortal Kombat?
Oh, 1,000,000%.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. You heard it here first.
Yes, because you know,
because
Bison, Raul Julia, you know, great screen presence.
Shang Tsung, great screen presence.
Wes Studi, great screen presence. Jean-Claude Van Damme, fantastic value for money. you know, the central pairing of Ken and Ryu are, you know, they've got something. They're good. The bizarreness of Kylie Minogue just kind of, just like being just she's shocked. She's like she's in shock for the whole film. Like she just yeah, like what am I doing here? Like Honda looks exactly Honda. He looks exactly like his character from the game.
Yes, it does.
yeah, like you know the sets, the locations, the tannoys, the. There's a moment, Goodney, of actual kind of like fun visual comedy where you've got the suit who's come from like basically the UN, the AN official, who's Simon Callow. Simon Callow is like an esteemed English actor. And he's like, you can't go to war. We've decided, you know, you shouldn't.
We've got and the orders Jean, here.
Jean-Claude, like, you know, total badass, puts on his helmet and then he jumps in his speedboat and zooms off. Just saying that sentence alone, Goodney, is better than 80% of Mortal Kombat. And he splashes him with like water. And it's a very split second thing. And like, as I made the note, I even made the other note being like, I'm reading too much into this. But he immediately pulls out like a white tissue and just like waves it. And like, it's...
cinema.
Oh, it's cinema. It's cinema, Goodney. It's cinema. Oh, and the speech that he gives about, you know, they say we should pack up and go home. But, you know, oh, it's like there's so much I love about this film. So much I love about this film.
We've done 50 episodes of the podcast, but we can all go home. Neil's been sitting here rambling on about how great this film is, but you know what? We can all go home. So, who wants to go home with Neil and watch Street Fighter? And who wants to come and watch Mortal Kombat with me?
Nobody wants to watch Mortal Kombat with me. Losers. Losers want to watch Mortal Kombat with me. Goodney, here it is. Episode 50, and I'm going to say it.
Mm-hmm.
It goes Street Fighter, Tekken, Mortal Kombat.
I'm out. I'm out. If you want to support the podcast, go to buymeacoffee.com/abaldopinion and you can donate towards no more nonsense like this. You can find us on social media, A Bald Opinion on Twitter and Instagram. Please tell Neil that he is wrong, that Mortal Kombat is in fact better than Street Fighter and that Mortal Kombat is better than Tekken. Thank you very much. And if you want to tweet at us, go for it. Go for it. Please, please. We accept everything. Next time on the podcast, we will do a film that you've probably never heard of before called Oregon Trail. Not Oregon Trail, Oregon Trail. So stay tuned.
Yes, guys. Thank you for sticking with this longer than usual episode. And thank you for sticking with us for 50 episodes and many deviations. We look forward to many more episodes, many more movies that will probably struggle to compete with Street Fighter, let's be honest. So as always, Goodney has been wrong, and you have been listening.
I guess we've been bald.
And these were our...
controversial opinions.